you hear that? That's what an estimated 500 horsepower sounds like. X-Go, give it to you. How about that? That's a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system with 18 speakers and a Beosonic sound experience. That's our legacy. You ready to be a part of it? X-Go, give it to you. Unlock the energy of the all-electric ZDX Type S. Give up. Order now at Acura.com.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
What's going on, everybody? Thank you so much for joining me here for this Wednesday edition of Fantasy MLB Today. We are a Sports Ethos presentation, of course, and I'm your host, Joe Orrico. You can find me over on Twitter at JoeOrrico99 and also at EthosFantasyBB. That's where we post all of our new fantasy baseball content, articles, podcasts, every bit of content you get over there. I posted an article today. It's my first in-season article. I went through all 30 teams talking about the most fantasy-relevant points, about 2,500 words for you there. Most of it is for subscribers, but the first six teams that I wrote about are free to preview there. So there's a link on my Twitter, and you can also find it in the MLB section on the website at sportsethos.com if you're not somebody who does use social media. But yeah, it's good to get back into the writing. I did a little bit of writing in the preseason. I mostly just do editing these days, so it's really nice to actually just sink my teeth. I mean, I tweet out stuff, right? Tweeting is essentially writing, but to actually get there on the computer and type out an article felt really, really good. So go and check that one out. But today we are going to be doing our first mailbag episode of the season. We did a bunch of them last year. I think for the last 3 months of the season or so, they were a weekly staple. Maybe not every single week, but we did quite a few mailbags down the stretch. You guys were always sending in just so many questions. And it was really great to see the engagement. And we put one out today. I do these on Twitter if you want to get your questions across, at JoeOrrico99, like I said. And it does get retweeted from the other accounts if you're following them. You can participate in these when I do them, though. So that's another good reason to go and follow at least one of the accounts that I mention on a daily basis. But we're going to dig into them. We got about 20 questions here. And we're going to start with the first one here. Why is every pitcher hurt before the season even begins? It's a little hyperbolic, but it's not even that much anymore because it's true. Pitching injuries are generally on the rise. It is, I think, tied to the increase in velocity that we have seen over the last 10, 20 years. Pitchers are throwing well over 100 miles an hour when that's not something we used to see on a very regular basis. And your body is not supposed to throw really at all. Like, to throw even just at a fairly slow pace, it's not a natural motion for your arm. It's not great for you. When you're throwing at that kind of advanced speed repeatedly, over and over and over again, 100 times, over and over and over, it's going to lead to more strain. And, you know, some people might think, well, 94, 96, 98, 92, what's the difference? It makes a difference. It does, and we've seen it. So I think a big part of it is the over-reliance on pitchers trying to get every little bit of velocity, which, I mean, the problem is that that is the more effective way of pitching. Like, the guys who do have more velocity are generally more successful. It's just the way that it works. It's harder to hit the balls that are faster. It's not too complicated on that front, but that does complicate the equation because the average pitcher coming up is going to want to throw as hard as possible, and it's going to lead to more arm injuries. So it is a problem. There's nothing we can do about it. I've been, you know, brutalized by some injuries myself, specifically Yuri Perez, right, a couple shares going into the season. There's nothing that we can really do about it. It's just the way the world works with baseball. You're going to draft, especially if you draft early, you're going to probably have a couple injured players heading into the season, and then you're going to have a bunch more that pop up during the year. So it's just a part of the game at this point. Best outfielder, points league moving forward, Kerry Carpenter, Lars Nootbaar, and Will Benson. Lars Nootbaar is usually the way that I would want to go here. The fact that he's been injured and kind of inconsistent as well in my eyes for a little while, it leads me to kind of go away from him and go more towards Will Benson. And it's a good question. They're all, I think, going to be very viable options. It doesn't specify what depth of points league is. I think that they're all worth rostering. I mean, Nootbaar, the way that he walks when he's healthy is massive. It's just I don't know exactly what his timeline is going to look like. I don't think it'll be that long, but it's also fairly crowded in the St. Louis outfield, and I'm not sure that he's 100% assured playing time out there. I could be wrong, but I'm not 100% sure. He's going through rehab. He's playing in the minor league, so I guess it probably won't be that long. But again, I'm just not 100% sure of what he is going to look like. Kerry Carpenter is somebody that I really like as well, but I think between the two of them, between Carpenter and Benson, it would be Benson for me. I really think that he is going to have more of an opportunity in Cincinnati now. It was funny because Cincinnati was the team where we were worried so much about who's going to play, and now they're, you know, really desperate for playing time in a lot of cases. They acquired Santiago Espinal because, you know, their infield is depleted and they lost TJ Friedl, and there's a lot going on. So Will Benson, I think from that perspective, is probably the way that I would go. I love that lineup. Even though they have suffered a few losses, they're still an incredible lineup, and Will Benson last year was just an absolute monster, getting on base at an outrageous clip. His OBP was 365. I mean, okay, maybe I overstated it, outrageous, but he was walking at a 12% rate, 11 homers, 19 stolen bases. He's got an amazing home park. I think his job is pretty secure. So I think for that question there, I would lean towards Benson. But these guys are all really, really great options. Benson has got off to a great start this year as well, and I think that he would be the guy that I am leaning at this point. Are Ricky Tiedemann and Aaron Ashby worth stashing in a keeper league? Ricky Tiedemann, absolutely. Aaron Ashby, it really depends on the depth. I'm going to specify for weeks going forward. Give me as much information as you possibly can. 10-team, 12-team. There's a few of you guys who did specify and sent pictures of your rosters and that kind of thing, which is really good and very helpful. Ricky Tiedemann in most keeper/dynasty leagues should be rostered. Now, and if you have two keepers, probably not, right? He's not going to be one of those two keepers. But I think most leagues, again, it's hard for me to say what the custom with the general thing is, because there's just so many different types of fantasy out there. But 8 to 10 keepers, I guess, is generally fairly common. I feel like Ricky Tiedemann is probably on the fringe, but like, I feel like he's got to be there considering where he is in terms of prospect status, what he is looking like he can do in terms of strikeout ability. I feel like he's probably there. Aaron Ashby, I don't think so. Like, I really like Aaron Ashby, but again, like, unless you have a lot of keepers, Aaron Ashby is going to be tough to be taken. Like, you'd probably need to have like 25 keepers to take Aaron Ashby. Where with Tiedemann, it's like if you have, I want to say like 8 maybe or so, that would make it worth, he'd probably be worth one of them, 8 or 10. That would probably be where I would be at on that question. Tiedemann, probably worth it. Aaron Ashby, likely not. My points league hasn't had waivers since the draft on March 22nd. That's a little bit strange. I can pick up two of the following: Casey Mize, Jared Jones, Kyle Bradish, Zach Littell, Reese Olsen, and Tanner Houck. How would you rank them? Well, you can pick up two of them. The number one priority there for me would be Jared Jones. His debut was incredible. His stuff number was one of the best stuff numbers we've seen from any starting pitcher thus far this year. There's a little bit of a concern about workload potentially, and I understand that. But while he is out there right now and he is pitching, you gotta pick him up, because that is just going to be some through-the-roof type of production from him while he's out there. Is he going to pitch 200 innings? No. Is it going to be 180? No. But you're probably looking at like 100 to 120 or so, and while he is healthy, I think he's the guy to pick up. The other guy I think would be Zach Littell. I really like what I saw in the first start from him. Now, he's heading into Coors. So that's not going to be a start situation for me. But I think going forward, he is the guy that I would want to have in that group as the number two, with Jared Jones being the one and Littell being the number two guy. The other ones are more streaming types. Casey Mize, Tanner Houck. I mean, Bradish is interesting, but I just don't really have that much faith considering the injury there. I don't know if his elbow is going to hold out for very long. So even if he comes back, it might just be a few starts. I don't know that he's worth holding on to in that type of situation when there are other guys available like that. So I think Jared Jones and Zach Littell are your pickups there. A couple of questions about AJ Puck. He is the drop. He was somebody that I mentioned in that article today. AJ Puck is somebody that I was pretty interested in. I thought that there was some changes that he made, and he, you know, just becoming a starting pitcher. It's so tricky, right? Like, you never know what a reliever to a starter is going to look like. We have the Garrett Crochet example of him just being absolutely filthy, and then you have AJ Puck, who has been awful against two terrible offenses. Pittsburgh and the Angels have both gotten to him pretty handily in these first two starts. So AJ Puck is a drop. I'm saying that for 10 and 12 team leagues. If you're in a 15 team league, again, it really depends on who you're dropping them for, because there's really not that many options available in the 15 team leagues. But I probably would give him another start or two in those type of formats, or I should say not another start or two in your lineup, but keep him on your bench and just see if this is maybe some early season nerves converting to an SP. I mean, he's really good. Like, the skills are really, really excellent, and he was great last year. Like, I just think it's maybe potentially something to do with just some nervousness becoming a starting pitcher. And I don't think it's like he's just bad now. It's not like he's throwing a hell of a lot of pitches in these starts, so it's not like he's gassed, I don't think, either. It's just maybe something between the ears. I don't think that really matters in a 10- or 12-team league. You can't really afford to let guys be doing this to you in 10- and 12-team leagues because there are so many great options available. But I think in a 15-teamer, he's probably a guy that you can probably hold on to for another start or two. Question about Bryce Terang. What's your feeling? Tied for the league lead with 6 stolen bases, showed some power. His minor league batting average wasn't bad. I like Bryce Terang. I talked about him yesterday. He's somebody that should be added, I think, in pretty much every single league. Let's see what his Yahoo roster percentage is up to right now. 33% still. Coming into today, he's not going to stick to this extent, but he's a top 20 player so far on Yahoo, second base and shortstop eligible. I think that he can be a really damn good asset for your fantasy teams this year. I wouldn't get carried away. I wouldn't be dropping like super, super established players for him. But I think that there's a good chance that, you know, he can steal close to 40 bases. I don't know exactly if, like, because there's a chance that he could steal 75 bases. So look what we saw with Ruiz last year. I think Terang is probably not to that same extent, but he's shown some massive, massive speed in the minor leagues. He could maybe go for 50, potentially. He could potentially even, like, hit 10, 12 homers. He's given you decent batting averages in the minor leagues. Nothing crazy, but maybe he could be a 250 guy with 10 and 12 homers and 35, 40 stolen bases. Like, I think that there is a lot of value there. I don't know if this is a question or a statement. I think he's a better pickup than Victor Scott. I would agree. At this point, Victor Scott is probably looking like he could get sent down. He hasn't performed terribly well so far. If you are using Victor Scott as, like, your stolen base handcuff and you're thinking, I didn't draft enough of them, I picked him up because, well, I needed to compensate for that. I think Terang is probably available in your league still, assuming you're in a 10 or a 12-teamer, because 15-teamers, Terang is not likely there. Most NFBC formats, he's not likely there either. But I think a lot of you guys, 10 and 12-teamers on different sites, are going to see Bryce Terang sitting on the waiver wire. And he's somebody that you should definitely consider. And as a one-for-one replacement for Victor Scott, I think that does make a lot of sense. What's a realistic call-up day for Jackson Holliday? I have no idea. The Orioles are so frustrating. I have no idea what goes on with them in terms of decision-making. I don't know why Arias is getting regular playing time still. I don't think he's all that great. He wasn't that great last year for them. 264 batting average, 4 homers and 360 at-bats. He's fine, I guess, whatever. 0 for 10 to start the year. He's 0 for 1 in today's game while I'm recording. Why is he taking up a spot on the team exactly? Why is Colton Cowser sitting on the bench every single day instead of playing in the minors if you're going to do this? And why is Jackson Holliday not getting regular at-bats in the major leagues already? There's a lot of weird questions that I don't think can be answered on this podcast about the Orioles. I think that they need to trade away a couple of players at the end of the day. They're too clogged, both with these kind of weird O'Hearn or Urias veteran types that aren't part of the long-term future. And then you got these young prospect types who are sitting there, who have done everything to prove that they belong and are sitting in the minor leagues because there's no room for them, I think, essentially. Or I really don't know what other reason for Jackson Holliday to not be at the majors at this point. But I think within a month is probably reasonable to expect for Jackson Holliday. And if you have a NA minor league type of spot, they call it NA on Yahoo. I forget what they call it on the different sites. But if you have a minor league stash spot, Jackson Holliday is somebody that would be worth using that on. When he comes up, I don't know that he's going to be, you know, Corbin Carroll, Bobby Witt, Julio Rodriguez type in the last couple years. Just situationally, he'll be bottom of the order type versus top of the order for those guys. I think it'll be a little bit different and not to the same extent. But he's one of the best prospects we've seen in the last few years. So when he does come up, you're going to want to have him. If you can stash him in advance of that, great. If it's going to cost you an active roster spot, that's a little bit different. I think you can justify it, but I think I probably would say, yeah, like it's probably worth it outside of maybe a 8 or a 10-team league if you're burning an actual bench spot. 12-team and beyond, I think that's worth it. And I think probably within the next month, yeah, you'll see him come up, hopefully. But again, who the hell knows with the Orioles these days? Should I sell high on Garrett Crochet since he hasn't pitched many innings in his career yet? Look, you're talking to one of the members of the Garrett Crochet fan club. I drafted him on about a third of my teams this year, roughly five out of my 14 teams I have him, so about a third there. I think that it makes sense to explore the market and see what people are willing to offer you, because if somebody is going to give you a top 50 player or a top, let's call it 20, 25 starting pitcher for Garrett Crochet, you'd be crazy not to take it. I don't know how everybody's individual league works. There's guys who have been in my home league in the past who make some absolutely outrageous trades, and they want to be trading all year long, and they're massive on this. As soon as somebody snaps up a couple weeks of value, they want to trade for them. So your league might be one of those leagues where Garrett Crochet right now is being valued at an absurdly high price. And if you are the owner slash manager, whatever you want to call it, you should explore cashing in on that. That's not to say dump them off right now at all costs. If somebody's going to give you Garrett Crochet's draft day value, then you tell him to kick rocks because he's worth well more than that now, especially last night. Like, what he did against the Braves was absolutely ridiculous. I watched almost every pitch he threw as somebody who's pretty invested financially in him for this season. And damn, like, and I shouldn't even say I'm that financially invested in him because his draft price wasn't that high, but, you know, those leagues are decently high entry fees, and he was somebody that I was watching thinking, well, I started him, it's the Braves, I'm a little nervous, it's a two-star week, which is why he got the start, right? It's a one-star week, just the Braves, there's no chance he's getting in there, but the fact that he has the Kansas City Royals start later in the week, he went in the lineup, and I was watching almost every pitch. He was inducing weak, awful contact from guys like Austin Riley and Ronald Acuna and Ozzie Albies. They looked foolish. They couldn't do anything. Marcell Ozuna hit a home run off of him that had an expected batting average of .70. It's a home run in only a few parks. He hit it 350 feet. Just this nonsense garbage type of home run. Not exactly, you know, Babe Ruth's 500-foot college shot, whatever you want to call it. It was just a nothing burger type of home run that got out. So Garrett Crochet dominated arguably the best lineup in baseball, his second straight great outing after having a great spring. That in and of itself should tell us that he is a little bit better than I think we were generally giving him credit for. Does that mean we shouldn't try and sell high on him, though? No. It's a good idea to just see what the market is. But if somebody's going to offer you, like, I don't know, let's call it Jose Berrios or Chris Bassett or somebody, like, it would have to be somebody a lot better than that. It would have to be, for me at this point, to sell Garrett Crochet, probably somebody who was close to, if not inside of the top 100 of ADP, roughly in that range. That would be my going rate at this point based on what we've seen. I think that he is just absolutely fantastic. Who can I get in return for Ellie De La Cruz? I offered him for Machado and was rejected. So this was a part of what I wrote today as well, that Ellie De La Cruz right now is obviously very concerning. The defense has been comically bad. I don't know what the hell he was doing in the field yesterday. He looked like an absolute moron. He's striking out almost 50% of the time. And I think that it's potentially going to end up with him back in AAA to figure things out. There's no need for the Reds, especially like we mentioned. There's been a few injuries. Is there really any need to rush things this year? Like, they're going to be without Matt McClain. The Friedel's hurt. It's still a developmental year for them. Do they need to have Ellie De La Cruz striking out 50% of the time, kicking the ball all over the infield? I think they may end up sending him back down. I don't think we are there yet, and I'm not, you know, I'm only maybe, let's call it 15, 20% of the way there to thinking that's a possibility. I don't think that this is the case yet, but Ellie De La Cruz may end up as kind of like a sell low type player. That also being said, I have to dunk my head in cold water and say it's been six games. Ellie De La Cruz could hit three home runs tomorrow, steal four bases the day after that, and then do the same thing again and again and again for the next week after, and it wouldn't surprise any of us if at the end of next week, Ellie De La Cruz had five homers and six stolen bases and was batting 400 because he has a hot week. And then we would have a completely different narrative about, well, is Ellie De La Cruz a first-rounder next year? Like, it's just very early in the season to make full judgments, and even when I say there's a chance of him getting sent down, I'm probably premature in that assessment. It's just the way that he is playing defense is awful. He has 10 strikeouts and 21 at-bats, I think. 21 at-bats. I don't have the page open anymore. I closed it, but it's been atrocious, all around atrocious for him. This is why he was a very risky investment in the second round, but people wanted to take that shot on the upside. I think that your offer here, I offered him for Manny Machado and was rejected. If that's the case in your league, and again, that's just one manager, but if that's the way your league is playing it, it's probably just better to hold him at this point, because Manny Machado, a week ago, was being drafted three or four, five rounds even potentially later. And the guy even commented here, Ellie was a second rounder. Wait, let me make sure I'm reading this right. Ellie was a second rounder, and Machado was a fifth rounder in this guy's league. And already, after a week, you're not getting that value of three rounds later. I'm not sure if your whole league is going to value him the same. There might be somebody who is, you know, willing to buy in for a fourth round type of player. But assuming that's the general value you're getting back, and you're already losing three rounds of draft day value after 6 days or 7 days, I think that you're better off just holding off on trading him at this point. It might get to a point in the next couple weeks where if it's still looking shit side up, you trade him. And you take that sixth or seventh rounder that you can get for him, maybe even worse. But I think at this point, it would be too soon to give up considering the massive type of potential we have for him still. Looking for a third baseman with Josh Jung out. That's a brutal one. They've already pushed the timeline back. Like I said yesterday, this is going to be something that really, really just pisses us off. And the timeline for injuries is never usually that clear. I initially thought the timeline would be 8 to 10. They announced it would be 6 weeks, and then they pushed it back already. And now it's looking more like 10, maybe even 12 weeks. So Josh Jung is probably a drop. As a side note, if you don't have if you don't have IL spots, then I think that Josh Jung is a pretty easy drop outside of very deep leagues. In terms of replacing him, would you trade O'Neill Cruz for either Machado or Spencer Steer? No, I would not. I value O'Neill Cruz ahead of both of those players. Spencer Steer is off to a great start. God bless him. He's not somebody that's going to sustain this. Manny Machado, I like, but I think O'Neill Cruz's upside is a first rounder, and Manny's is probably best case scenario somewhere in the second, third round, if everything goes perfectly, and I don't foresee that necessarily happening in San Diego for him. So I think between those options, there's not really anything I would do for in terms of trading O'Neill Cruz. There's a different route you can go, whether with a different trade or free agent option, but I would not be doing it at the expense of O'Neill Cruz. The next question, Jose Siri versus Sedan Rafaela. This one is interesting to me. Rafaela is somebody that I don't know a hell of a lot about, as somebody you guys know. Like, I'm not a massive, massive prospect guy. Everything that I have heard about this guy, everything I've seen about him is very, very, very promising. He is supposed to be amazing. And if you look at his numbers in the minor leagues, just even a quick glance at his numbers will tell you the kid was pretty exceptional, hitting well over 300, over the minor leagues. Different stints, right? Some of them he was a little bit lower, but just looking at 2023 in AAA, what he did, batted .312 with 14 homers in 48 games. Massive stolen base numbers as well if you look at what he did in AA last year, 60 games, 30 stolen bases, batted .294, six homers at that level. So if you put what he did last year together, AA and AAA, 20 homers, 36 stolen bases, hitting above .300. Just incredible stuff. He seems to have a very regular role in this Red Sox lineup. He's in the middle of it, batting sixth, batting seventh. He has started six out of the seven games so far as well. Shortstop and outfield eligibility. Like, that is massive stuff. Now, Jose Siri on the other side of that has been one of my most talked about, most favorite players this year. I drafted him a few times. I wish I drafted him more. He's played every single day. We are looking at, is it eight games played now for them, or is it seven? I think it's, yeah, it's seven games for the Rays. He started every single one. And what we're looking at so far is already 3 out of 4 on stolen base attempts. I wrote about this in my article today. He is stealing at a massive clip. He stole, on average last year, he attempted a stolen base once every 6.7 games. So far, he's averaging an attempt one every 1.5 games so far this year. It's a very small sample size, but I do think Jose Siri is a potential 30-30 bat. He's already shown it at the big league level. He's a little farther along in the development process than Rafael. He gave us 25 and 12 already last year. I would take the Rays lineup over the Red Sox. I think it's fairly close. The Rays are just kind of that magic that you don't even know where it comes from, but they always just do well. And I think I would generally take them over the Red Sox, although it's fairly close. So I think at this point, I would lean Jose Siri. You're saying you need RBI and stolen bases. I think it's Jose Siri. The stolen bases are going to be probably a little more leaned in towards the Rafaela category, or Rafaela side of that, I should say. But I don't even think it'll be by enough to really justify any massive difference. I think you're probably looking at, for Rafaela, like 17, 18, 20, something like that. And I think Siri is 25-ish. I don't even know, actually. It's like, it's very hard to figure out because I'm projecting a big increase for Siri. So I might be over or under shooting it. Based on these early numbers, he looks like he could steal 40. But realistically, Siri's probably 20 to 25. Rafaela potentially could be like 30, 35, 40 based on the minor league numbers. But realistically speaking, 20, 25. So it's honestly very close in terms of stolen bases. And considering the rest of the package that you're getting, I think it's Jose Siri. He could give you 30 homers. He just gave you 25 last year. Rafaela's best-case outcome is probably, like, I don't know, 17 or so. So I think that Jose Siri is the way that I would lean here. How concerned are we about Nolan Jones? Very concerned. Nolan Jones was not somebody that I was interested in, like, at all. I just couldn't get around to doing it in the fourth round, fifth round, sometimes even in the third round. I don't know. The only thing that he had going for him in my mind was a great home park, and I think that was really overblown. I think what he did last year was, and maybe I'm underselling him, like, he does have good power, but the home park was really a massive part of what was putting him into that range. If he was playing for the Nationals, or even not even somebody as bad as the Nationals, let's just say it was an average team he's playing on, a 500 type of team, would we be that interested outside of the Coors factor? I think it's really that. It's like the stolen bases kind of came out of nowhere, and they're not something that I expected to come back. The batting average was inflated by this stupidly high BABIP, which, again, not something that you can expect to come back to that same extent. And he started off miserably. He has 4 errors. He's striking out all over the place. He's looking awful. So, yeah, I'm fairly worried about Nolan Jones. I don't have him anywhere because the price was absurd, and I just couldn't do it to myself in the fourth round, taking him as my second hitter or my third hitter. I just didn't understand the hype. I really didn't. The stolen bases came out of nowhere. He took advantage of the rules. Good for him, but it's not something I think was going to stick this year. And again, I'm maybe speaking out of my ass. We're 6-7 games in, 8 games in, whatever it's been for him. I might be jumping the gun, but I really just don't think he's all that special. The power is the only thing that really is appealing to me. That lineup around him is garbage. Half of his games, you're not even comfortable starting him. So there's really just not a hell of a lot there. If he hasn't turned it around by the end of April, I'll give him April. I will give him April. Let's not be hasty. Even April might be too small of a sample size, but if we see this dreadful, awful play in the field and at the dish for the entirety of April, I'd be willing to dump him in 10 and 12 team leagues. 15ers are different. There's not really anybody sitting out there that you could justify, but I think in a lot of cases you'd be pretty okay to get rid of him in 10 and 12 team leagues, assuming that this is something that carries on for the rest of April. I'm not jumping ship yet, but it's something that could definitely happen if we don't see this change. He hasn't played at Coors yet. Again, that's something that we need to factor in. But again, half of the games are not going to be at Coors. If this is what we get when he's not at Coors, then he's probably not worth rostering. That's just the brass tacks of it for a lot of these Coors players. And I think we artificially inflate them just because of their home park. And I don't think it makes a hell of a lot of sense. All right, we got a fun one here. I like it because it starts off with disregarding position, and I don't have to worry about roster construction or anything of that nature. I can just look directly at the players. So, rest of season, not worrying about the position, Isak Paredes, Tyro Estrada, Rhys Hoskins, or Eloy Jimenez. I think it's got to be my boy Tyro Estrada still. You could maybe go with Rhys Hoskins. He's got off to a great start in Milwaukee. Eloy shouldn't be in the conversation, respectfully. Eloy is a drop for me in a lot of cases. I am done. Enough is enough already. He can't stay healthy again already. He's hurt. It's just too much to take. I don't think it's considered that serious day-to-day. It's an adductor strain or something. Yeah, it's an adductor. That's what it is. Enough is enough already. I'm just tired of him, tired of the nonsense. Last year, 456 plate appearances, or 456 at-bats. Which was good. It was great. But that's like the absolute best case scenario. Most leagues, I'm not worrying about him at all. I think it comes down to Estrada and Hoskins. And for me, Estrada is the most well-rounded of the bunch. Like, he is off to not a great start. Again, that's something I wrote about in the article today about Estrada. But I'm getting questions already about dropping him. After a week, a top 140, 130 ADP guy, maybe in some circles he went in the 150s, 160s, but somebody that was being drafted fairly high up that we're already thinking about cutting after like a week. Like, we're not there yet, especially somebody with a track record. Like, Estrada has a couple of years worth of really good fantasy production under his belt and a new manager in town that should allow him to steal more. Now, he's not stealing so far through the first week, but he hasn't really been on base much in the first week, so it's hard to really say one way or the other what's going to happen there. But I think Tyro Estrada is my pick of the litter, followed by Hoskins, followed by Paredes, and then a long gap, and then Eloy Jimenez. What to do with Zach Allen? Trade, hold. I've seen a lot of talk about Zach Allen that's like, oh, he's been awful. I literally saw people say he's floundered in his first two starts. Somebody's used that phrase. He has victories in both of them. Yes, one of them was Colorado. Yeah, the other one was the Yankees. And to be fair, that Colorado start, he had 16 runs of run support. Like, he was not going to lose that game, so whatever. And then he goes 6 shutout innings against the Yankees, where the underlying stuff is not amazing. It wasn't fantastic. But through his 11 innings pitched, he is a sub-1 ERA. He has won both of his games. He struck out 9. His whip is at 1 exactly. I think people are panicking about absolutely nothing. Like, yeah, below the surface, it was like a 25% CSW. He wasn't missing bats as often as he probably should have through these first two starts. 3 strikeouts and 5 innings against that Colorado offense. You know, you and I listening here could probably get 1 or 2 ourselves against that lineup. They are absolute dog water. So you'd hope that Gallen could do a little bit better, but it's hard to be that concerned at this point. Like, if you're really that worried and you want to trade him, his value is very, very solid right now. There's been some starting pitchers, George Kirby, cough, who have been awful, who were drafted in that same type of range. In fact, Kirby was picked earlier than Gallen in most drafts. On pretty much every draft I was in, Kirby went ahead of Gallen. Maybe actually October, November, early drafts, Gallen may have been ahead, but Kirby was the guy that was end of the second, beginning of the third in some 15-teamers. He's been awful. Gallen has been good. I know it's, you know, too binary. It's too simple to just say it like that, but there's been a lot worse that you could have gotten out of some of your pitchers that you drafted early on this year. Gallen has been fine. If you're really worried and want to swap him for somebody, then I wouldn't be doing it for any less value than you got on draft day. Wherever you took him, probably in the 40s or the 50s, if you're not getting that same type of value back, I'm just holding him because there's no real worry in my mind about what to do there with Zach Allen. I think he's okay. Like, he was overused a little bit last year, not by, I think it wasn't their fault. They went to the World Series. So by nature, you throw 245 innings, you're going to be a little overused. But I think that's a little bit overblown, and I think that he's generally going to be fine. He wasn't a huge target of mine. I was below consensus on him already. But this is, I think, getting out of hand with people saying it's like, oh, it's really bad for Gallen. Like, I think we need to just pump the brakes and really look at what he's done. He's been pretty fine. We got a little bit of a specific roster question, but it does allow me to just talk about these players as well. Uribe and Garrett Whitlock are available. Think it makes sense to drop Nestor Cortes and Michael King for those two guys. So I think it's probably a little bit too early to drop either of them. Again, most of these starting pitchers, especially guys who were taken in the top 200 picks, if you're dropping them after one start, it's usually going to turn out terribly for you. Usually, like if you were doing that after every time a guy in the top 200 picks had a bad start in the first week of the year, somebody should track the numbers on that, but you would be down in the long run dropping those guys. Now, Michael King is an odd case because he's not really a starting pitcher. In my eyes, he's more of a reliever. He had like 7 walks the other day, and it was dreadful. Is it always going to be that bad? I think likely not. I don't think it's always going to be quite that bad, but I do think he ends up in the bullpen again at some point, and he might be competing for saves in the back end there. I think it's Suarez's job, but I don't know that he's somebody that's solidified as a starting pitcher there. So I could maybe make the case for him, but I still think it's a little bit early. You can't just forget about how great he was as a starting pitcher down the stretch last year. So I'm not ready to give up on either of them, to be honest. Like, Uribe and Whitlock are nice, and it looks like your team probably could use a reliever here. But I don't think it should come at the expense of those guys. I think maybe, and this looks like a fairly shallow league, it's an ESPN roster. I think that the cut, it might be Nestor, just based on how shallow the roster is. It's either Nestor or maybe Jordan Montgomery, one of those two guys, if you're going to do it. And honestly, the way that it's looking with the relievers, you're pretty light on relievers, but in a lot of cases, I'd say it's heading towards Tanner Scott potentially being a drop as well. This guy has been, like, just brutal in spring, brutal to start the year, not great stuff out of him at all. But I think at this point, I might honestly revert that and go Nestor, just looking at how shallow the league is. Like, I think he might be the guy, but it's either him or Jordan Montgomery as kind of a toss-up there. We don't really know what Jomo's going to look like yet. Nestor didn't have a great first start, but again, it's so early to be giving up on these guys. Like, it's so early. Top 150 picks, top 200 picks, one bad outing, and you're done. It's just, I'd probably just default to doing nothing, honestly. And there's been a couple of questions in here about Nestor. Like, there's probably nothing to really be done there. I think that he is just somebody that you hold on to outside of the shallowest of shallow leagues. And your case is kind of a toss-up. If you wanted to hold him, if you wanted to drop him, it's very close in these type of shallow leagues. You can churn and burn a lot, but again, it's just so early. Nestor could come out and shove the next 3 outings, and then you'd be kicking yourself, and it's very tricky. But I think in this type of format, you can kind of get away with that sort of thing. So it's not like you have to be married to him, but it's still super, super early to give up on guys. That's kind of a huge main point of what we're talking about here. In general, this time of year, in all the content, that giving up after a week is generally bad play, unless we're talking about, like, Alex Lang, you can give up on. That one's an easy one. Esteri Ruiz, sure, but certain guys, like Nestor, has a track record of success. Last year was tough. He was hurt. It wasn't a great year. He could very, very easily bounce back. So I just think it'd be kind of premature in general to give up on him or anybody that's struggling up inside of those top 200 picks. But that'll do it, guys. I think I've got to all of your questions. There was a question that was in Spanish, and I put it through the translator, and it said something to Jorge Polanco, and then it just, I couldn't figure it out. The translators that are out there, I'm sorry, I just couldn't get it to make sense to me. I like Jorge Polanco, though. I mean, I'm not sure what the question is, but I really like Jorge Polanco. But in any event, thank you guys for participating. I'm going to do these every now and again, once every couple weeks maybe, maybe once a month. We'll see. But just keep an eye out on social at JoeOrico99 over on Twitter and EthosFantasyBB as well, where you guys will see all of these posts, you know, promoting this kind of stuff. And then you'll see the podcasts and articles and all that posted there as well. So, guys, thank you for tuning in. We'll be back again tomorrow. But until then, take care. Have a great day.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car riding your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. Auto Trader.
From muddy jungle paths to snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder is ready to take you to some of the most phenomenal destinations on Earth. In a Pathfinder, it's more than just the arrival. The real excitement comes from the ride to get there. With 7 drive modes, Pathfinder's available intelligent 4-wheel drive is built for some of the most epic journeys. So chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures in the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. Intelligent 4-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.